Hello, you're listening to Playback Daily. It's Friday, the 21st of February. I'm Louise Herity, and here's some of what's coming up.
I suppose the absolute certainty that Ireland would have always had that, yes, we always engage with the US president, whoever he or she is. I think as this presidency unfolds, there's now a question mark in my mind about that.
She's, you know, had a similar life to me. You know, she's modelled, she's been an actress, she's been very much in the public eye like I have for many years. And it just seemed like the right fit.
I was never a real drinker, very, very occasionally I might have drank alcohol. But when I decided to join the church, that was my big challenge, to stop drinking tea and coffee.
We'll kick it off with some film reviews for the weekend. And on last night's Arena, Kay Sheehy was joined by Dee Mullumby and Joe Griffin, who have been to the movies.
We'll start, of course, with I'm Still Here, as a lot of Oscar nods here. Directed by Walter Salles, it stars Fernanda Torres and recalls a brutal time in Brazilian history of the 60s and 70s when a right-wing coup threatened the citizens and supporters of the left. Dee, give us the historical context here.
Yeah, so our setting is 1970 in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. This is kind of following on from the 1964 Brazilian coup d'etat. So we see, like, you know, military vehicles kind of driving around the place, kind of disturbing, I suppose, what would otherwise be a quite a peaceful scene. So there's a former congressman, Rubens Paiva, and this is all based on a true story, by the way. He's just returned home after 6 years of self-exile. His tenure was revoked, and he basically lives this quite idyllic life with his wife, Eunice, who is played by Oscar-nominated actress Fernanda Torres. They have five children. They live in this absolutely stunning house. It is by the beach. You can see the children kind of running down to the beach, playing. There's a little boy who kind of takes in a dog that he finds in the streets and everything. But their world really comes crashing down when a military raid takes place in their home one day, which results in kind of the arrest of Rubens. And kind of, yeah, it really breaks down, I suppose, this peaceful family life that's been established.
Yes, Joe. I think Walter Salles said that he was a teenager in 1971 and he knew the family and visited this wonderful house that he has captured so well.
Yeah, it's interesting to think that in the early scenes you see some of the kids from the family playing football on the beach together with other kids from the neighbourhood. And I imagine that Walter Salles was one of those kids who played soccer on the beach with those guys. It shows the kind of environment that Salles and that the family grew up in, middle class, liberal, creative community. And
yes, there's music. There's the walls are lined with bookcases.
Yeah, the music, the soundtrack in this film is fantastic. There's pop music and rock music from the era, both from within Brazil and without. The father at one stage gives out to the kids for listening to gringo music, he calls it. Like the French and American pop music that comes through the speakers. So there's a lovely sense of time and place and location. As one of my favourite things about the film is that it feels like a 70s movie, not just because of its setting, but because of the look. It has a lovely warm cinematography. It was shot in film. There's a lot of 8mm, which gives a lovely immediacy to it. And then, of course, loads of films from the 70s were rightfully very paranoid. So it has that kind of paranoid atmosphere of people calling to the house, representing the government, just asking questions. So, yeah, it's a period piece that feels like it could have come out during that period.
Now, there's a scene where the authorities raid the house and they take Rubens away. And then Fernanda Torres, Eunice, the character of the mother and the wife, is left really to hold the fort. Mm-hmm. What kind of demeanour has she got? Is she feisty fighter or is she very protective? What approach does she have to their dilemma?
Yeah, Fernanda Torres, it has to be said, gives an absolutely incredible performance in this. She got an Oscar nomination, and actually, would you believe it's the first time in almost 50 years that two non-English performances have been nominated for the Best Actress Oscar. Her and Carla Sofia Gascon in Emilia Perez was also nominated. So I think what Torres does so well is how much of her performance is kind of happening beneath the surface. You can see her kind of smile, give that smile well, that, you know, there's so much kind of concern and fear behind, as, like, you know, we would associate with so many matriarchs kind of holding it all together for the sake of the children, you know. But there is a lot of fear there. There is a lot of confusion there as she is watching her husband be taken away. But at the same time, she's trying to stay calm and that there's nothing to worry about for the sake of the children. And I suppose later on in the film, as she's trying to, like, figure out, you know, exactly what happened with her husband, she has to maintain that demeanour, even though there's more kind of fear and uncertainty in their lives than ever before. So I think Torres really deserves a lot of credit for her brilliant performance here.
And how is the outside world, this military dictatorship, portrayed in the film? Do we see a lot of that, Joe?
We see as much as the filmmakers intended, which is, I think, that it's opaque. So there's a really good scene in the first act when Ruben's taken away and Eunice is asking questions and being taken by the same authorities. And the withholding of information and the mystery behind everything that should be more straightforward, that the legal infrastructure is just not there. So a lot of the film is about asking questions, about seeking truth, even if it can take decades. So I think Salas and the crew and the filmmakers held back as much as possible. Even when people arrived at the house, they don't introduce themselves properly. There's a veil of mystery, almost consistent, almost to the end.
Yes, we know about those military coups across South America and the disappearance. Like, people mainly didn't come back. So is there that awful fear the Rubens is gone, is dead?
Yes, that fear is definitely there throughout the film. And it's funny, as I was watching this movie, I couldn't help but think of, like, our own Irish history of kind of the disappeared. And I'd wonder if this film would end up kind of striking a chord, particularly with an Irish audience, given our own history with that. So yeah, there is a lot of fear there. And I think it's really interesting that you see how Ruben's disappearance impacts all of the family members. So I spoke a bit about Eunice, but also they have these five children, and they're all different ages. And you can see the three older of the daughters, they're quite involved. They're asking a lot of questions. They're really striving for the truth. And I suppose they're almost kind of forced more so into adulthood than the two younger ones, who just kind of accept everything, like, the way it is, accept what their mother is saying, you know, as truth, though. So I thought that was a really kind of interesting aspect to it as well.
So overall, Joe, stars out of five, did you think it was a gripping story about this kind of heroic woman and her husband who is taken?
Yeah, I thought it was really substantial. I really liked it. 4 stars for me.
4 stars from you, and from you, dear.
4 stars from me. My only criticism of it would be that we learn kind of a bit more through, like, titles at the end of the film, what happened to Eunice later on. And I would have kind of liked to see that incorporated into the movie, just because she led such a fascinating kind of political career in her later life. But it's still a really great movie. 4 stars.
4 stars from both of you. That's from I'm Still Here. Next, a serious change of tone in the splatter horror film The Monkey, directed by Osgood Perkins, son of the famous actor Anthony Perkins. Identical twin boys Hal and Bill find a new toy to play with, a monkey unknown to them has homicidal tendencies. 25 years later, the killing starts up again, and now the estranged brothers are forced to take the creatures on. So let's have a clip from earlier in the film, I think. Here, Hal and Bill, played by Christian Convery, get some morbid facts of life from their mum, played by Tatiana Maslany.
Everybody dies. And that's life. I'll die. And you will both die. And all of your friends and their parents and all of their pets and everybody. Some of us peacefully in our sleep. And some of us horribly, violently, tied up with clothesline and screaming through duct tape over our mouths and all that jazz. And to hell with it. Oh, come on, let's go dancing.
tough words of warning there from the mum, played by Tatiana Maslany, and Christian Convery plays both of the boys there, Hal and Bill. So, Joe, this is a film of two halves. Hal and Bill as kids are played by Christian Convery, and then as adults played by Theo James. Bring us into the world of the monkey.
Yes, so I'm a big fan of in horror movies when weird artifacts turn up. The opening scene is actually one of my favourites in the film, where their father is trying to get rid of it in this shop of mysterious and ugly knickknacks. The monkey, you might have seen variations of this toy, although they keep insisting on the film that it's not a toy. It is a toy. It's a wind-up monkey. You would have seen it using symbols in the Toy Story variations, and they actually, in the original short story, it was using symbols.
The Stephen King short story.
Yes, but Disney apparently owned the copyright to a cymbal clanging monkey, so this monkey drums the drums instead, which is very ominous. And so it's kind of a mystery horror in which the twins, now grown up, played by Theo James, are trying to... There's a more moral twin and a more amoral one. And the moral one is trying to track down this monkey to make sure other people don't turn the dial and the monkey drums. And when the monkey drums, something bad happens. So it's kind of a mystery, black comedy thriller, strong shades of Final Destination in the elaborate Rube Goldberg death scenes, which were the highlight, if you like that kind of thing.
And it's based on a Stephen King short story. So are there lots of nods to other work that we'd know from Stephen King?
Absolutely. I mean, even from hearing of the story construct, in that it follows these two characters when they're boys and later in adulthood, will be very reminiscent, I think, to anybody who's seen, the two-part movie It, or the TV movie version of that. That whole idea of childhood trauma kind of revisiting the individual as an adult is a very strong theme that Stephen King utilises in a lot of his work. It's set in Maine, same as It. It obviously incorporates horror elements. Bullying is a big theme in it. Hal is at the mercy of both his twin and some very nasty girls at school. There's an absent father. You've got discussions around puberty. The kids watch this educational video on the subject matter. So a lot of the kind of tried and tested Stephen King tropes are there. And I suppose maybe that's partly why Osgood Perkins kind of wanted to take on this movie. Stephen King is such a well-known, figure and everything. But this probably wouldn't be one of his best known works at that.
Now, it's always tough when there's a change of actor, isn't there, halfway through a film. The Christian Convery is, I think, very strong in the first half, and this then it is handed over to Theo James. How does he pick up as the older twins?
I think he was fantastic in this, actually. And you might know Theo James from playing rich jerks or alpha kind of bully types in things like The White Lotus, where he has been really effective and he's very conventionally good-looking leading man. Whereas in this, he's more of a kind of Clark Kent figure. He's more socially awkward and he's constantly terrified. And my favourite moments of his acting is when he is reacting to something horrific that has just happened. He's got a great shriek, much better than I expected when I'd seen him in other things.
Were you happy with both incarnations of the twins?
I actually didn't like Theo James's performance, if I'm honest. I thought Christian Convery, in fairness, was very good, and he had quite a lot to kind of carry in that first half of the movie. But I thought Theo James was quite weak as the grown-up Hal and Bill. As the lead character, I just found him a bit dull, a bit uninspiring, and I know that's partly meant to be his character, but at the same time, when you're the lead, you don't want a character that's quite that dull.
Stars out of 5 for The Monkey from you.
I thought it was quite fun.
3.5. Okay, not quite sure. What about you, dear?
It fell apart a little in the final act, but it was also quite funny and entertaining. So I'll give it 3 stars.
3 stars. That's for The Monkey. Now, finally, from brothers to sisters now, and more trauma in September says. July and September are the siblings in question. They have very intense bond, but September is the boss. Bullying at school moves the family from England to Ireland, where things take a turn for the worse. Paris. Award-winning French actor Ariane Labed makes her directing debut here, and she'll be talking to us on Arena on Monday night. Let's hear from the sisters and the control September has over July. September is played by Pascal Kahn and July is Mia Tharia.
September says, turn around. September says, touch your nose with your tongue. Do 10 push-ups. You lose life.
Silly me.
September says, engrave my name on that window pane.
That's Pascal Kahn there as September and Mia Tharia as July. So it's this intense relationship between the two sisters. It's a thriller? Is it a horror film?
It's kind of tough to categorise it. I suppose you'd call it like a family drama slash mystery, because there is this intensity to the relationship. And even in moments like that where you're just kind of sitting there and she's like, you know, cutting into the window, like it really kind of gets to you. So maybe like psychological drama would be the best way to describe it, I suppose. The relationship between September and July, I have to say, absolutely hooked me. Now, I do have three younger sisters myself, so I very much related to the weird sisters element.
Are you going to tell us which one? Are you a bully September? Or
Oh no, I'm not admitting that on air. But yeah, so September in the relationship, she's very controlling, and she can be a little cruel almost. You know, she's the one that bosses July around. She makes up the games that they have to follow. But at the same time, you can kind of respect the fact that September is so like that she stands up for July against all the bullies when there's no one else there kind of to defend her and stuff.
And Joe, horrible things happen to July. She is very bullied at school and some of it's very violent.
Yeah, it's quite a hard and stressful watch at times. And not to be flippant, but funnily enough, last week, twice I wrote School is a Horror Movie, like in my notes for two separate films this week. And also like The Monkey, the sibling is both an antagonist and a protector during some of the exchanges that happens. Yeah, it's a hard watch. Other Stephen King parallels, even though this is not Stephen King related, is Carrie. It reminded me a bit of, with the cruelty meted out like to teenage girls who don't quite fit in. So it's also quite a modern and relevant take, because sadly some bullying is aided by technology, as mobile phone correspondences can up the ante.
And the Ariane Labed, the director, is an actress. Mm-hmm. And she does get very good performances out of her actors in this.
Yes, out of both the actresses who are playing July and September, Mia Tharia and Pascal Kahn. And actually, it's kind of a three-prong movie. We have to mention here as well the two girls, their single mother, artist Sheila, played by Iraqi Thakrar, who some people might recognise. She was in the next Netflix series, Sex Education. But she's kind of the third lead in this movie. And she's really at a loss with how to handle her girls. And she's an artist herself. So all she's doing, I suppose, is trying to love her daughters and to create this kind of, you know, protective environment from them, from the outside world that doesn't really respect their uniqueness. So I think the writer-director, Ariane Labed, she based this movie on the book Sisters by Daisy Johnson. She really gets three phenomenal performances out of those actresses. And I just love her direction here. Like small moments like we heard in the clip there with the carving on the window, having a few drinks in the pub or a child's game, just carry such intensity and such emotion. And you're absolutely hooked and compelled as to what's going to happen
stars
next.
Stars out of five from you, Dee.
I'm going to give this 4 out of 5 stars. I really thought it was fascinating, and it shows what these kind of like low budget co-productions can really accomplish.
I get the feeling, Joe, you didn't like it so much.
Not as much. I respected it a lot more than I liked it. 3 for me.
Dee Malumbi and Joe Griffin on Arena with Kay Sheehy. staying on the movie theme. And on Morning Ireland this morning, we heard about how Amazon have taken full creative control of the Bond franchise. Brian Lloyd, entertainment journalist and film critic, joined Gavin Jennings to discuss.
The name's Bond. James Bond.
That's Daniel Craig there, the last actor to play the British spy James Bond and the last under the control of the Broccoli dynasty, who started the Bond films in 1962 but are now in the control of Amazon. They bought MGM, the parent company, a few years ago but have now taken over full creative control too. Let's speak to Brian Lloyd, entertainment journalist and film critic. Morning, Brian.
Morning, how are you?
What do you make of this move?
It's pretty interesting. I mean, it's been fairly heavily reported that Amazon MGM and Eon Productions, which is led by Michael G. Wilson, who was Albert Broccoli's stepson, and Barbara Broccoli, his daughter, it had been well reported that the two entities had essentially been in a lot of confrontations with Amazon MGM over the direction of Bond. Amazon MGM essentially viewed Bond kind of the same way that Disney viewed Marvel Studios, that they basically wanted to pump out as much content as possible. So that meant, you know, spin-off series, TV series, cartoons, you name it, anything and everything that could be used to turn it into more than just a film series, Amazon MGM was interested in, because obviously they also own Prime Video and their idea is to basically stock that with as much content as possible. Whereas Michael G. Wilson and Barbara Broccoli very much saw it as a film-only franchise, that it was, you know, they would produce a film every 3 to 4 years. They would select the actor, the director, the story, the script, the whole lot of it. Whereas Amazon MGM were more interested in really just kind of creating more out of it than just a single film.
So, like Disney did with Marvel and indeed with the Star Wars franchise, does this mean we're going to see spin-offs or, well, even just another movie?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, I would not be surprised if, say, 6, 7, 8 years from now, you're seeing a Money Penny film or a Money Penny TV series, and, you know, you're seeing a series about M as a younger person or something like that, or, you know, there's a cartoon series about Q and all of his inventions.
That's okay,
like that,
though, isn't it?
Please, I mean, you know, this notion of, like, you know, the Bond is something to be protected, that it's, you know, almost like a listed building, I think is pretty ridiculous. When you go back to, for example, Thunderball, which was in 1965, and there was a huge argument over that as to how, I suppose, ridiculous it was getting. You know, you had Sean Connery arriving onto the scene in a jetpack. And then, you know, you even think of something like You Only Live Twice, where Bond arrived into one scene, you know, in this sort of like makeshift helicopter, and he got plastic surgery to look like a Japanese man. I mean, the Bond series has always been quite ridiculous. I mean, you only have to look at something like Moonraker even to know that, you know, this was a series that never really took itself seriously. That was always kind of, I guess, guided by the winds of the culture, you know, that sort of way. Like, you know, when, by the time Pierce Brosnan came on for GoldenEye, you know, things had moved on. Political correctness was a thing. There was the end of the Soviet Union, so you couldn't very well have a sort of mustache-twirling Soviet bad guy anymore, you know?
That was Brian Lloyd, entertainment journalist and film critic, chatting to Gavin Jennings on Morning Ireland. Well, there was definitely a movie theme running across the day. Well, the Dublin International Film Festival is on over the weekend. And Oliver Callan spoke to none other than former model, actress and singer Twiggy, who is the subject of a new documentary directed by Sadie Frost.
Along with the Beatles crossing Abbey Road, it is the early photographs of our next guest that have become the instant visual shorthand for 1960s London, the swinging 60s, and a chance haircut made this woman a world-famous supermodel for decades. And now comes along a documentary film, an extraordinary film, and it's about the life of this woman. And it's directed by Sadie Frost, no less. The contributors include Dustin Hoffman and Joanna Lumley. The film is getting an outing at the Dublin International Film Festival itself on Monday. Good morning. Who could this be? Only Twiggy. Good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you? Are you well?
I'm very well, touch wood. Yes, I'm very well. Busy at the moment because, as you've just said, the film's coming out.
Yes.
So I'm very excited coming to Dublin. We're thrilled we've got into the Dublin Film Festival, so that's lovely.
Oh, good. And you look really well and happy in this film, which is about your life. Have you seen it yet in full?
Oh, yes, yes.
You have.
Yeah, we contributed to it, you know, fully. It's
You're
been
in
like
it.
2.5 years. I'm in it, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I'll probably, there's so much of me in it that if you don't like me, don't go.
Are you an introspective person, Twiggy, by the way? Do you often look back on your life over the years?
Not really. I mean, you know, I tend in life to, you know, be going forward doing the things I'm doing now. So it's been quite a journey to go on. And it came about because I do a podcast called Tea with Twiggy.
Mm-hmm.
And Sadie Frost did a film on Mary Quant about 3 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And asked if she could come on my podcast to talk about it. And that's how my documentary came about, because I asked her if she was going to do any more. Because I love the one on Mary Quant.
Yeah.
And she said, oh, I love doing the research on the 60s, and I'd love to do somebody else that was part of that period. And then she said, oh, I should do you. So,
and she did.
We went out, and she did. So we went out for lunch. Because over the years, I have been asked to do this with other people, and it either for whatever reason didn't work out, or, you know, we didn't feel it was the right time. But I got on very well with Sadie. I love that she was a woman, and that, you know, she's, you know, had a similar life to me. You know, she's modeled, she's been an actress, she's been very much in the public eye like I have for many years. And it just seemed like the right fit. And it's been, it's taken about 2.5 years, because there was endless footage from that 60s period that she had to go through and pick what she wanted. And actually, she found clips that I'd never seen.
I was wondering, had you seen? Yeah. What is that like, looking back at a teenage you becoming world famous?
I know, it's funny, because I remember it clearly, obviously, because it was, you know, up until that moment in 1966, I'd been a schoolgirl, a very ordinary, very shy, you know, suburban schoolgirl. So suddenly, within a month and a half, I was flying to Paris, flying to New York. I mean, it was madness, really. So watching it, it's lovely memories, because most of the memories were lovely. And but it is very nostalgic. And seeing my mum and dad, who are no longer with us, you know, that's obviously quite nostalgic. And various things that have happened in my life, because, you know, every life has ups and downs and happy times and sad times. So, you know, it's all in there.
It is.
But I think Sadie's done a very good job of putting it together and telling the story.
Take us back to the early days for you, Twiggy, because there's obviously a haircut that changes your life. It changes fashion, indeed.
It did. Yeah, as I said, I was a schoolgirl. Somebody sent me to see a magazine, a woman on a magazine, and because she thought I had a kind of, you know, a look. Because I went to a grammar school, so we weren't allowed to wear makeup. But at weekends, like all teenage girls, I played with makeup, and I created that, you know, those eyelashes and the ones underneath, and that's what I used to do at weekends. And somebody saw me, and she had a friend on a magazine, and she sent me along, and she said, "Well, you're too small to be a model, but maybe you can do headshots." Because in those days, and I'm 5'6". In those days, if you had to be over 5'8" to go to a model agency and be taken on. So and I was tiny. I mean, you can see in the pictures, I was this tiny little thing. And so I went to see this woman, and she said, "Go and have your hair done, because it's a mess." And that was the kind of key thing, because she sent me to a very upmarket hairdressers in Mayfair in London, called Leonard of Mayfair. And Leonard saw me and came over and said, "Can I cut your hair?" And I didn't want my hair cut, actually, but I was too shy to say no. So he cut my, it took about 7 hours. They cut it and coloured it and cut it and coloured it. And then he sent me off to a lovely photographer called Barry Latigan, who took that picture that you talked about with, you know, with the Fair Isle sweater. That was the first photograph I had taken. It's probably the most well-known photo of me, probably. Right. And I went back to school, and Leonard hung the picture of the haircut in his salon.
Yeah.
And one of his clients was a big journalist in England for the Daily Express called Deirdre McSharry. And she came in to have her hair done and said, "Oh, I love the haircut. Who's the girl?" And he said, "Oh, she's a schoolgirl." And she said, "I want to meet her." I got a phone call at my mum's house in Neasden saying, "Will you come in for an interview?" I mean, I was so green, I didn't even know what an interview was. You know, I was a schoolgirl.
Yeah.
And so I got on the bus and went up to Fleet Street and met this lovely lady called Deirdre. She talked to me. And 3 weeks later, she published a whole page saying, "Twiggy, the face of 66. And I got the name Twiggy because my legs were so skinny.
There you go. And does everybody call you Twiggy even to this day?
They do. They do. I think, it stuck for life, really. But I've become quite fond of it. It's been quite good to me, so.
But it's Leslie at home, I presume, here and there.
Well, my husband calls me Twig, so most of my friends call me Twig.
Twig, it has to be shortened again.
Yeah, it's got shortened again.
And I'm sure in certain environments you insist on Dame Twiggy for British citizens.
Oh. I know, that was amazing. But, it was a great honour.
Well, I'm glad after seven...
I don't make people call me Dame, and I don't make them curtsy or anything. it was a lovely day. It was a thrill.
I was just thinking, Deirdre McSharry, we'd say over here, I think she might be an Irish woman, and she's in the documentary as well.
Yeah, she is. We didn't use it in the film because, you know, you get so much footage, you can't use everything. But I actually, when they interviewed her, I hadn't seen Deirdre since, you know, those days in the 60s. And
really?
I went up with the film crew and when they filmed her, and then I came out as a surprise. And we sat, it was so lovely. I hadn't seen her in all those years. She's amazing.
The Irish woman who discovered her. And she becomes editor of Cosmopolitan later. So she had a great career.
She did, yeah. She had an amazing career. And she's a wonderful lady.
I was reading an interview that you did with The Guardian when you turned 60. And they ask you, you know, was it strange that the defining era of your life happened to you when you were 16? I suppose a better question is, do you think that was the defining era of your life?
Well, it's interesting because obviously it's the thing that people... That's why I'm quite pleased with the documentary because, you know, I have done many, many other things.
You have.
In the years after the 60s. But most people, if you say my name, they will immediately think of the 60s, which is fine. But, you know, probably my proudest moment is in the 1980s, I did a big Broadway show, a musical, which was all singing and dancing, and it was a big hit show, and we ran for 18 months on Broadway. And so for me, that's when I think about my life, I think about that as a very high point in my career, and many other things. You know, I was lucky enough to be work with Sir Peter Hall, one of the great theatre directors. I did Mrs. Warren's Profession with him on tour, and I've done albums, but you know. But if you say my name, most people will think of the 60s, which is fine. It's fine.
You got a Tony nomination for that musical.
I did.
You won 2 Golden Globes in the 70s, the Tony nominations in the 80s. We saw you in Ab Fab in the 90s, the face of M&S in the noughties. And I believe you were on the cover of Portugal's Vogue only last November.
I was. A lovely photographer called Rachel Smith took that picture. It's amazing. I'm gonna keep going on. I love work. Yeah.
Because some of these retrospective films are almost like a full stop in many ways, aren't they? Because we don't get to see obviously what happens next. You might have to update the film.
Yes, that's true. Well, you can only go. I mean, we've only gone as far as when Sadie stopped filming, which was the middle of last year. So there is, if you towards the end of the documentary, you see me in the studio with a lovely singer-songwriter, Amy Wodge, who I'm working with on an album, and various other things I'm working on. So I will not stop.
She can't be stopped.
She can't be stopped.
High points. There are obviously sad moments as well. And your daughter, Carly, is in the film. And she talks about the death of her father, who was your husband, your first husband.
Yeah,
and she was a child. Yeah. And the press treatment of her was just extraordinary.
It was appalling. Well, you know, there are most of the press, you know, I've had a very, very nice relationship with the press over all these years. And most of the press are very respectful and very nice. And I mean, you know, unless you get involved in something very scandalous, they leave you alone.
Yeah.
But obviously that was a horrible time, and certainly horrible for her. And it was horrible for me, but more for her. You know, she was 5 years old, bless her heart, when he had the massive heart attack. So, yeah, but as I said earlier, you know, every life has happy times and very, you know, sad times and very difficult times. And obviously my number one priority at that time was my daughter.
Yeah. You say in the film,
making sure she was okay.
You say in the film that you became overprotective of her, you feel, looking
probably,
back.
Probably, yeah, I did. Well, she was five, you know, and she'd lost her daddy. So I had to move in and make sure. Well, I was always there, obviously. Wherever I went, she went with me. And we've still got a very, very, I mean, she's a grown-up woman and happily has given me two beautiful grandchildren. And I see her all the time. You know, we're very, very close. And I thank God for that. It's wonderful.
And your husband now, you paint a real picture of romance in the film too, the pair
well,
of you.
We met in our middle years, and we've both been through difficult relations. You know, I'd lost a husband and he'd broken up with his partner. So we met at a time when we were both single, which was quite fortunate in, you know, your middle years. That doesn't often happen. And we've been together 40 years this year.
Wow. Congratulations.
So married 37, which in our business is pretty good.
Yes. Well, you're very sweet together, because we don't often see couples, particularly if it's the second time out, being affectionate or to each other. I don't know what's strange.
No. We're touch wood. I don't want to talk too much about it. I don't want to tempt fate.
Exactly. Yeah.
But no, he's, you know, and he's my best friend. And you know, he makes me laugh, and you know, we work together. We do projects together, which is nice.
Very nice. Look, it is a charmed life. Between Paul McCartney singing Blackbird over breakfast to you and your husband, you have another Phil Spector shooting into a ceiling at a party, which again is at the other end of the spectrum.
Know.
It is a fascinating, and you are coming to Dublin, I believe, or are you?
I am. I'm so excited. I love Dublin. Yeah, because the Dublin Film Festival screens it on Monday night, so I will be there with Sadie, and we're going to do a Q&A after the film.
Fantastic.
And so I'm coming out on Sunday with my daughter. I'm going to bring her, because she's never been to Dublin, so I said, you've got to come. So
it's about time. It's about time. Well, have a fabulous time, Twiggy. Thank you so much for chatting to us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Good luck.
That was Twiggy chatting to Oliver Callan today. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, more commonly known as the Mormon Church, has a small but growing presence in Ireland. And last year, the church announced plans to build its first temple here, with a reputation for strong community values and missionary outreach. Well, reporter Maura Fay visited a Mormon congregation to visit their worship firsthand, and she had this report on Today with Claire Byrne.
So last weekend, I attended Sunday service at the church's meeting house in Clonsilla in Dublin. In the Mormon faith, a meeting house is not as sacred as a temple. Non-members of the religion can attend services in a meeting house, but not a service in a temple. Their Sunday worship is called a sacrament meeting. There's an opening hymn, then there's a sacrament service. Congregants partake of bread and water, not wine, as Mormons abstain from alcohol. And then a mix of ordinary members of the church give sermons on spiritual topics. It lasts about an hour in total. I met with Bishop Michael Holton. He's the leader of the congregation in Clonsilla. Now, being a bishop in the LDS church is different to bishop roles in other churches. It's a completely voluntary role, and you're expected to serve between 5 to 7 years. You still work your normal job and can be married and have children. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or the LDS Church, is a Christian religion. They do believe in the Bible, but they also believe in the Book of Mormon, which is an additional book of scripture. According to LDS teachings, it was translated by Joseph Smith in the early 19th century from ancient gold plates given to him by an angel named Moroni, hence why they are sometimes referred to as the Mormon Church. Bishop Holton estimates that there are about 4,000 to 5,000 members of the LDS Church in Ireland, and he told me how his faith typically differs from other faiths, like the Roman Catholic Church, for instance.
There'll be some things that are similar and some things that are different. We have a hierarchy in the church, like they do in the Roman Catholic Church. We don't have a lot of iconography, like they would in the Catholic Church, a lot of ritual. It's much more simple and pared down. So we're not Catholic, we're not Protestant, we don't fit into either of those characterizations. What we believe is that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is a restoration of the church that Jesus Christ organized. And so he called people to lead, apostles and 70s, and we have that in our church. But he also recognized that everybody can play a role in teaching and in healing and in helping. And so we have that as well. So it's kind of those two things. It's a bit more democratic than a Roman Catholic church would be, but not quite as unstructured without a hierarchy as some of the evangelical churches might be.
Would you say that there are a lot of misconceptions out there about your church?
Yeah, definitely there will be misconceptions. I think one of the chief ones would be that it's an American church. There are more members outside of America than there are inside America. It's definitely a global church, and that's reflected now increasingly in the leadership that we see. We have an English apostle, we have a German apostle, we have a Chinese American apostle. So we see changes happening even in the higher echelons of the church. But certainly there's misconceptions about our history. Do we still practice polygamy? No, we don't, which is probably a chief thing that people have. Do we believe in Christ? Yes, we do. There's a variety of misconceptions that people have, and depending on who they've learned about the church from. And that's why our simple invitation is, if you want to know more, come and see what we do.
The church announced last year that they're going to be building a temple in Ireland. Is that progressing?
Yes. So this was very exciting to be able to hear that a temple is going to be announced or going to be built in Ireland. We have two temples over in the UK and two more announced over there, one in Birmingham, one in Edinburgh. But that means we have to travel, and some people can't travel for a variety of reasons. So to have a temple in Ireland will be a wonderful thing. A temple is a bit different from a church in that you have to be a member to be able to go to it. And there are certain other ordinances that we perform in the temple that we don't perform in churches, like eternal marriage, for example, the ordinance of eternal marriage. And so having a temple in our own country that we can go to, people from Belfast and Dublin and everywhere else can go to, will be a wonderful blessing. It'll take about 5 years before it's built. So we don't know the site yet. We do know it'll be somewhere in the Dublin locality, but we don't know. But it'll be a big difference even for me. It'll be maybe 1 hour away versus taking a whole, half a day to travel over to England or whatever. So very much looking forward to having the temple.
Hear more about their beliefs. That was Bishop Michael Holton. So who else did you speak to, Maura?
So in the Mormon Church, young men are strongly encouraged to do 2 years of missionary work when they turn 18. Young women can also do missionary work for 18 months, but it's considered more optional rather than a duty. Traditionally, LDS teachings prioritize marriage and family for women. I spoke to one young missionary about what inspired him to come to Ireland on missionary work.
So my full name is Tor Magnus Birkeland Hansen. I'm from Norway, from a small place called Kristiansand. And my background is quite different to most people from the church. I have been a member for 2 years. I was baptized as a 16-year-old. My dad was a member, but he didn't want to force me to go to church or anything, because we all have our own agency to choose, and that was important for him, as it should be for everyone.
How old are you?
I'm 19, sorry.
Day to day, what are the kind of things that you're doing on a mission? Are you, is it a case that you're going around knocking on people's doors and saying, hey, would you like to join our church, or what is it?
Yeah, sometimes we knock on doors and invite people to come to church. Sometimes we go to more populated places and we just talk to people on the streets. You are really used to talking to people when you get on a mission, which is good. Something else we do is that we study the scriptures to increase our own knowledge. We pray, and yeah.
Do you find you get a positive reception in Ireland?
I think that wherever you are in the world doing this, I think that a lot of people will not be very open for it, including here in Ireland. But I think I love the people here, and no matter what, I think I can see, like, if I were home and somebody tried to, like, I guess, convince me that their religion was the right one, I would be kind of how I see most people are here. But that's the thing. I know that this religion is the true religion, the true church of Jesus Christ. And that's why I'm here, to spread that.
What's been the most interesting thing you've observed about Irish culture while you've been here so far?
The spice bag was pretty good. I guess a lot of, like, funny phrases that people use, like you say, use a lot, and gas crack, and a lot of weird stuff. I think in general it's quite similar to back home in Norway, but there's those small differences.
That's Tormungus there from Norway. Now, Maura, you touched on the role of women in the Mormon church, and the church has faced criticism in the past for its male-dominated leadership structure. So what do the female members have to say about all of that?
I spoke to Liz McGrath from Clonsilla. She was raised Roman Catholic and became a baptised member of the LDS Church 35 years ago after becoming interested in the religion through her neighbour. Ecclesiastically, the LDS Church would be firmly committed to traditional gender roles and has a patriarchal structure. I asked Liz how she felt about being a woman in the Mormon Church, and she told me about all the various leadership roles she has held within it.
I served as the Stake Relief Society president. I also served as the Stake Primary president, which was looking after the children, meant travelling to different units, checking in on them. And I have to say, the whole time, I have never once felt this is a man's church. I link in with our bishop now at the moment, so I meet with him regularly together. We make plans for, he's ultimately responsible for the boys, 11 to 18. I'm responsible for the girls. I would say, you know, we link in together, we make plans, we plan activities, we figure out what's best for them. I've never felt that I was less than any of the male leaders in the church. I've never felt to feel like that.
I know one of the things that members of the church aren't allowed to do is drink tea or coffee. So did you have to give that up when you joined?
Would you believe that was the hardest thing I had to do when I joined the church? It was coffee. So I really did like, I grew up, you know, we were a typical Irish, you know, not very well off family. And I remember as a child, as a teenager, my one treat was at 11 o'clock every day during the summer holidays, my mum would bring me in and we'd make what we called milky coffee, you know. So it was the good stuff, the coffee made with the milk. So I was never a real drinker. Very, very occasionally I might have drank alcohol. But when I decided to join the church, that was my big challenge, to stop drinking tea and coffee. When you visit people, it's still that thing that they feel a bit awkward. You know, well, what will I give you? You know, what are you going to have if you don't want tea or coffee? And I'll be just, oh, water is fine.
Liz McGrath ending Maura Fey's report on Today with Claire Byrne. And on the gathering today, Claire was joined by Fianna Fáil TD Paul McAuliffe, Green Party leader and TD Roderick O'Gorman, political editor with the Journal.ie Christina Finn, and journalist and commentator Brenda Power. And the first topic up for discussion was the news that broke this morning when Sinn Féin announced that they will not attend the White House for St Patrick's Day.
And I suppose as a party in opposition, Sinn Féin have the luxury of being able to make that decision that they're not going to engage. Like, it's important for people to understand that the St. Patrick's diplomatic mission is much broader than just the White House event. It involves discussions in regard to trade. It's at federal level, state level. There's governors involved. I'm really perplexed at what the ask of Sinn Féin is. They're sort of saying that we're not going, but we want the Taoiseach to be able to make the following points. And I sort of, there's a degree of hypocrisy in that position. I think Ireland has key interests here. And I think around the world, governments are using the opportunity to engage with the new administration to make the points that are important to them and to do so at a meeting. Like the King of Jordan is able to sit down with Donald Trump and talk to him about their relationship. At the same time, we'll have fundamental disagreements about what the proposals are in regard to Gaza. So I don't understand the logic behind Sinn Féin's position. I think there's a real hypocrisy in it in terms of asking us to make particular statements, but they're not willing to attend. Well, Roderick, and I think it's a missed opportunity.
Roderick, can I bring you in on this? Because there are plenty of people in this country who will agree with what Matt Carthy had to say on this programme earlier, that there comes a time when you have to take a stand. Did they make the right call?
Well, I wasn't surprised at the call they made. I think it would have been untenable for them to travel in light of the stance they've taken on Gaza. But in particular, I think probably the decision of the SDLP a couple of weeks ago would have put real pressure on them in terms of the contrast that would have created if Sinn Féin were to go and the SDLP weren't to go. Obviously, it is different. Mary Lou isn't attending as she's a leader of an opposition party. The position of the Taoiseach as leader of the country is different. And when he speaks on behalf of the country. So, you know, over the last number of months, anticipating a potential Trump presidency, you know, I was thinking, what is the right way to handle this? And I do believe in engagement. I do believe in being in the room and making the case to people, even with people you fundamentally disagree with, as Paul said. Mm-hmm. But I would make one caveat. Even the last week, the scale of change that the Trump presidency represents, this isn't just now somebody who I and many people profoundly disagree with politically, but has, you know, won an election and we have to accept that. Like the way in which he's undermining norms domestically and internationally, like the open embrace of a dictator, this is so different to his last presidency that whereas the Taoiseach will travel this year, there will be engagement this year.
Are you saying that there's a question mark over whether he should go?
The Taoiseach will go this year.
Yeah, but
and
do you
think
he
will raise those points. But I think I suppose the absolute certainty that Ireland would have always had that, yes, we always engage with the US president, whoever he or she is. I think as this presidency unfolds, there's now a question mark in my mind about that I didn't expect to have.
Because, Paul, you mentioned the King of Jordan, and the same thing happened to the Indian Prime Minister when they went into the Oval Office. They were embarrassed. They were humiliated in front of the world's press in the Oval Office. And there is a great risk, very high risk, given the issue of tariffs and the trade surplus, that the same thing will happen to Micheál Martin.
Yeah, but you have to be in the room to make those points. And Micheál Martin is the Taoiseach of Ireland.
To be humiliated and embarrassed.
There's a very significant trade between Ireland and the United States. There are hundreds of thousands of people whose jobs depend on that. And there's a responsibility of the Taoiseach to go to the United States and to make the case for why we should have a positive trade relationship. I think Roderick points to one thing. There is a difference between an opposition party making a decision and then a office holder making that decision. And it is worrying that it would appear that the First Minister of Northern Ireland now won't be in Washington that week. Mm-hmm. I'm not clear on all of the details, but it would appear that that's the case.
Oh, it is the case, yeah.
As the United States is a guarantor of the Good Friday Agreement.
Now, we don't know what Emma Little-Pengelly is going to do, but that decision has yet to be...
Michelle O'Neill was very keen to take the post of First Minister. She was very keen to say what that would mean, that she'd be the First Minister for everybody. It would appear on this occasion they've made a political decision, and I'm just saying that has a definite knock-on consequences in terms of the peace process. Mm-hmm. And it's aimed at President Trump. It will have an impact cross-party, both Democrats and Republicans.
Okay, Christina, did that come up? You were at the press conference at 10 o'clock. Did that come up?
It did, and she was saying there's a distinction to be made between herself and the Taoiseach, and that they're two separate things, and that Emma could make her own call on whether she wants to go. I think it would have been a very different scenario had the institutions not been up and running, had she made the decision not to go. I think things are a lot more on an even keel at the moment in terms of, I suppose, the sort of lobbying and engagement that they would be wanting to have with the American side of things on that space. But I do think, you know, it's interesting to see Mary Lou McDonald making this decision now. Pressure was put on her last year as well because the SDLP hadn't gone. So the pressure was there. But I suppose the point is the players have changed now. You know, Biden, there was a lot of question marks over the US role here and what sort of influence we could have on Patrick's Day last year in terms yeah. of speaking to Joe Biden, that we had a better relationship. You know, he loved Ireland, that he might actually listen to us. Mary Lou McDonald wouldn't have that ear of Trump on this trip. I suppose the real impact might be things like the Speaker's lunch, which is held on Capitol Hill. She'd be sitting down next to some very serious American power players in terms of for a guts of an hour, the kind of conversation she would have. The Ireland Funds dinner is held during the week, which is like a massive event where you'd have both Democrats and Republicans there. And there's a lot of schmoozing around between, you know, powerful people there. So there are probably opportunities there that are lost for Sinn Féin in terms of that argument that they're making. But I think politically back home, it'll play very well for them. I think the reaction so far that I've seen is that it's welcome to a degree. It's a very different scenario of the Taoiseach not going as the leader of the opposition. Mm-hmm. So I think it's an interesting call that they have made. She has said now that it's not something they're going to do. Like, it's not set in stone that this is a 4-year boycott, that it's going to be made
on a
year by year basis, depending what happens.
Okay, Brenda, your take on this. Does it make things very tricky now for Micheál Martin going over there? If he's invited.
And I mean, that's the point you made to Matt Carty just now. Well, hang on a second. We don't know that you were ever going to get an invitation or that anybody is going to get an invitation. So, I mean, to me, there's a whiff of throwing the head or having the hoo-ha, as you put it, before it becomes moot, because they may not be invited at all. That's one thing. I think it's a hugely irresponsible thing to do. Of course, it makes life very difficult for the Taoiseach. As Paul said, this is not just about the bowl of shamrock, and it's not even just about the incumbent. This is a privilege that a very small peripheral country has had for a number of years, and to put it in jeopardy in any way. And also, another thing, you said to Mike Carty there, what do you expect Donald Trump's reaction to this will be? And he said, who knows? Absolutely. But if you have any small glimpse of what Donald Trump is like over the past 4 years, you know a couple of things about him. First of all, he is a very petty, very vindictive and, oh, very powerful man who will have absolutely no compunction about punishing us for this. We have very few friends in the current regime in Washington. His commerce secretary is already on record as saying it's a joke that Ireland, of all places, is running a trade deficit at America's expense. And one more point, Claire. The day after those horrific scenes in Gaza yesterday, and whatever your sympathies, those were horrific scenes where the bodies of two little babies were handed over to cheering and singing and clapping. Gazans there with their own children to cheer these scenes in circumstances where they had been asked, and the Red Cross has confirmed that they asked for dignity and privacy for the handing over of these bodies, one of whom doesn't even appear to be the woman who was clearly separated from her kids when she was murdered. The fact is that whatever way you play this, that this will be seen in Washington, whether intentionally or not, as a pro-Hamas move by a very prominent Irish political party.
But this is a party of opposition. I mean, surely that distinction can be made.
You trusting Donald Trump to make those distinctions? He thinks millions of people were killed in Ukraine. The details pass over that man's head. What will be taken away from this is that Ireland is anti-Israel.
As heard on Today with Claire Byrne. And that's all we have time for on Friday's Playback Daily. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and have a great weekend.